From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's the indelible voice of Sam Cooke. With A Change Is Gonna Come, it was released the year after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech at the 1963 March in Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Popularly known as the I Have a Dream speech, Dr. King's words there have become cemented in history as a crucial message during the civil rights movement. U.S. Representative John Lewis was there and remembered it at a 2017 event at the Truman Library Institute. We'll play that.
But I think on that day, August 28, 1963, he was deeply inspired and moved. He had the ability or the capacity to turn the marble steps of the Lincoln Memorial into a modern-day pulpit. Yeah. And he preached. He really did. That was an unbelievable message to America and to the world. So when you travel across and around America, around the world, people know I have a dream.
They do.
A dream deeply rooted in the American dream. And we're still trying to fulfill that dream.
The National Center for Civil and Human Rights is commemorating what would have been Dr. King's 90th birthday this year with a new permanent installation, a new exhibit of drafts and notes from some of Dr. King's most enduring speeches and sermons. Nicole Moore is manager of education and museum content for the center. She was part of the team that worked to curate this special exhibit, and it's called The Meaning of Hope, the best of the Morehouse College Martin Luther King Jr. collection. Nicole, welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. This exhibit, The Meaning of Hope, highlights not just the speeches themselves, mm-hmm. but the notes, the drafts. What does this collection reveal about Dr. King's thought process?
For me, the thing that it reveals the most is that he took his time. He had multiple drafts. He had people review his work. And it was the thoughtfulness that he put into it because he knew that his words had power and they had meaning. And you want to make sure that the correct message got across and what he really wanted to say to the people. And so when you're looking at these drafts and you see the scratches and you're like, oh, okay, he's really working through this. You see the care that he had.
This is a man who seems larger than life, yeah. I think, in memory. Towering historical figure. But to see his handwriting in this exhibit, the mm-hmm. papers that he touched, rough drafts, as mm-hmm. you said, the imperfect lines mm-hmm. that didn't make it into the grand speeches. Does it humanize him in some way?
Oh, absolutely. To me, that is the most humanizing aspect of it. And it's not even the drafts. One of the things that we're going to show is the letter from Birmingham Jail. And it was the one that was published in the Christian Century. And it's already published. It's out there. But the document that people will see, it actually has him self-editing. Hmm. Like, the letter's published. Your point has been made.
We can see it on Google. We can find it anywhere.
But he had gone back and he's like, you know what? I should have said this. Or he's scratching everything out. And so you see that constant self-editing, that constant improving. And to me, that is one of the most humanizing aspects. It's not, this is good enough. It's, I can always be better.
Mm. His writing mm-hmm. of and drafts are also in a recently redesigned permanent installation. The center has completely redesigned its first floor. And this permanent installation is called Fragments. It mm-hmm. leads visitors into this Morehouse collection of papers. It's a metal structure. Polisher and Abbott Miller designed it. How would you describe it?
I would describe it as going to be a wall of words. And it's beautiful. And what you're looking at, it's these pieces of metal that have Dr. King, various words. So you'll see hope, peace, his signature a couple of times, but really just kind of these strong words out of his various sermons and speeches. And his handwriting is beautiful to me. And when you see it and when it's magnified, it'll have light coming through. It's kind of the sense of calm when you see it. It's just like, yeah, okay, hope. I have that. Peace. That's going to come through. Yes. And what it hopes to do is it really just kind of hopes to explain not just his writing style and who he is, but also how we got, you know, how the collection came back to Atlanta.
Hmm.
What does Dr. King mean to the city of Atlanta and why his words are so important?
How did it come back to Atlanta?
So the papers were at Sotheby's Auction House. A couple of city leaders and a couple of folks came to then Mayor Franklin and said, look, I think Andrew Young was definitely a part of that conversation. It was like, hey, these papers are for sale. And if they disperse through private hands, we're going to lose this incredible legacy. And so these leaders got together with Mayor Franklin and they raised the money to buy the papers off of auction before they were already laid out. People were visiting them at Sotheby's and they managed to secure the papers and bring them back to Atlanta. They are now at Morehouse College. They're housed at the Woodruff Library there. And the center is where we rotate various sermons, speeches, letters, just pieces of that 13,000-piece collection.
That's Nicole Moore. She's Manager of Education and Museum Content for the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. And we're learning about a new exhibit from the center showcasing the best of Morehouse College's Martin Luther King Jr. collections. Well, Nicole, you just told us how this collection came back to Atlanta. And the exhibit features the best of this Morehouse College collection. You mentioned the letter from the Birmingham jail. What else is in there? I see notes on normalcy, never again. That is the speech that became I Have a Dream.
Yes, and we have the draft of it. So it's 5 pages of this draft. And a lot of people only remember I Have a Dream, which was the end. It's that moment where King flips his notes over and he's like, you know what? I got this.
So that was unscripted.
It was unscripted, but it wasn't the first time that he had said, I had a dream. He had been going around to different churches and different places and kind of pieced that together in some of those sermons and those speeches. But this is the first time that you're hearing it on such a large platform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's life changing. But normalcy, the beginning of the speech, is extremely powerful itself. And so people will see that beginning draft. And then we have a pamphlet that basically breaks down what everybody knows is I Have a Dream.
And using bits of his sermons was characteristic in speeches. In fact, we have the drum major instinct. This mm-hmm. is from King's final sermon at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. Give us a little bit of the groundwork for this.
So the drum major instinct is, to me, one of his most powerful sermons because it embodies who he was. And he's basically saying that everybody wants to be in charge. Everybody wants to be known, but it's not about you.
Mm.
And when you harness the drum major instinct and when you realize that it's bigger than yourself, then things really take place. And he was warning us against having that drum major, I need to be in front and I need to be in the spotlight. It was basically kind of a very subtle, humble yourself and realize that this isn't just about you. It's a larger picture.
That seems so prescient, given that mm-hmm. he was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, April 4th, 1968, mm-hmm. after that sermon. How do scholars look at it? Do they see a sign of, okay, I am one man, and I don't know, given what happened afterwards, some sort of foretelling?
I think so. I mean, he spoke a lot about how he didn't think he would live to see 40. And unfortunately, he was right. But he kind of knew, somehow he just knew that, you know, I'm not long for this world. But while I'm here, I want to create an impact and I want to do the most that I can to help people, not just African-Americans, but people in general. And so it's just really powerful when you're looking at drum major and when scholars are examining drum major coupled with I've been to the mountaintop. It really is just kind of laying everything out. And in drum major was so powerful that was played at his funeral. And he essentially eulogizes himself in Ebenezer.
Wow. Well, there are also correspondences mm-hmm. with leaders, Thurgood Marshall, President John F. Kennedy. What do we see in these kind of letters?
So the Kennedy ones,
You're very excited about
this. I'm jumping around in my chair. Because he had, first of all, he had the ear of presidents, not just President Kennedy, but there's letters to Eisenhower. In the collection, there's letters to Johnson. But these Kennedy telegrams where President John F. Kennedy is like, Dr. King, I need you to come to this meeting. And then King's like, absolutely, yes, I'm there. And then shortly after, he's like, actually, I kind of got something else I can't get out of. And so to me, that was so amazing because it said, first of all, he told a president, actually, I got to go somewhere else. So what could have been more pressing than this meeting with the president? Yeah. But it also shows that he honored commitments. He wasn't, whatever the other engagement was, he wasn't going to blow that off because the president called him. He said, maybe we can get together later and discuss these things. And it showed how committed he was, that he wasn't just going to dismiss something just because a president was there. And that dedication and that commitment, that's important because sometimes you want to feel like, oh, I'll just run to this something that most people would say is bigger and more important. But what's more important than serving the people?
Mm. Any big surprises for you or new as you worked and went through these papers to curate this exhibit?
Since I've done the rotation a few times, it's not much that surprises me anymore, but looking at his trial sermon at Dexter and realizing that that trial sermon is basically what makes him the pastor at Dexter. Mm-hmm. And realizing that that's where it began. Dexter and being in Montgomery is really where he becomes kind of ingrained in civil rights, particularly with the bus boycott, with the Montgomery Improvement Association. All of that happens because he's not the bus boycott and the movement there, but his involvement happens because he's the pastor at Dexter. And so to see that trial sermon and then to read his acceptance speech, which we also have in the exhibit, to me, it's a groundbreaking document because that led to so many other things that we now cherish and revere about him.
Mm-hmm. Last year marked 50 years since the assassination of Dr. King. He was only 39 years mm-hmm. old, which is stunning to think of. Yet there is this vast anthology of speeches and photos and footage of Dr. King. So how is the Center for Civil and Human Rights hoping that you can expand and improve curation and learning and understanding of Dr. King?
We've recently launched the National Content Advisory Committee, and this is a group of King scholars, including Dr. Claiborne Carson. We have Dr. Vicki Crawford, who's the director of the Morehouse College Martin Luther King Jr. Collection, and a host of others. And these scholars are indelved in the work of King. They know his work inside and out, as well as the civil rights movement. And with the help of these scholars, we'll be able to really broaden how we look at King so that we are further enriching people's experience and their knowledge base on Dr. King through this exhibit.
You are then enriching, deepening our mm-hmm. vision of Dr. King. But I'm thinking of what Representative John Lewis said, we are still trying to fill Dr. King's dreams. What do you think of Dr. King's vision? What do you think he would see as he looks out in the world at this moment? Where are we in that dream?
I think he would still have hope. And I think that is the one thing to really remember and understand. The work is never done. He understood that. Congressman Lewis understands that. And he would still have hope that we are going to get there. And that as progress happens, that's just a mile marker on the way to freedom. But it's never ending, and we can't rest. We just have to keep going.
Nicole Moore, she's Manager of Education and Museum Content for the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. The new exhibition, The Meaning of Hope, the Best of the Morehouse College Martin Luther King Jr. Collection, opened this past weekend. There are a number of other events, including a redesign and a new permanent installation to mark what would have been the 90th birthday of Dr. King. And we are going to leave you with Nina Simone's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, which became a civil rights anthem. And we're continuing our celebration of the Dr. King holiday with an interview with Zernona Clayton. That's after the break when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're paying tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. today. On August 16th of 1967, King spoke at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference annual convention in Atlanta.
This is our hope for the future. With this faith, we will be able to sing in some not too distant tomorrow with a cosmic past tense. We have overcome. We have overcome deep in my heart, I did believe we would overcome.
Among the conference planners, former journalist Zernona Clayton, now an icon of the civil rights movement. My colleague Tony Harris spoke with Zernona about her memories of Dr. King.
Zernona Clayton was the first woman of color to have her own Atlanta television show on WAGA-TV.
But I'm also an everlasting friend of Martin Luther King. I'm in Atlanta at the invitation of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from 1963 to now.
Clayton worked with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SLIC for short, and was a close advisor to Dr. King. These days, she's CEO of the Trumpet Awards Foundation. Now in her late 80s, she remembers King as if it were yesterday. We joined her at her Atlanta office. She points to several pictures hanging on the wall of Dr. King. One shows her on stage with King in front of a large group of children. He's speaking in an Atlanta neighborhood with a lot of public housing.
I didn't feel that Dr. King had a relationship with the people he preached about, you know, the poor kids, so to speak. So I said, Dr. King, let's have a Christmas party and invite the children and have a big party for the kids. And you could be Santa Claus. And he thought it was a great idea. He wouldn't put a Santa Claus suit on. But he said, okay, you know, I'll be a part of it. So what's significant about that picture, that was the first time he met with those neighborhood kids, but it launched a spirit of support for children in public housing, and we were responsible for it. So I love that picture, his meeting for me.
Inside her office, Zernona shared more of her thoughts and memories of Dr. King.
I think that Martin Luther King's spirit was an infusion for young people to get up and do something. And, you know, he said, Dr. King said, that we've got to have moments in our life that we go out and do something that has meaning to the point that we're willing to die for it. So I saw the picture in my mind that those young people were saying, we're tired of being shot up in our schools, feeling unsafe. We're going to do something about this gun control. And I saw Martin Luther King again.
You know, Zernona, the great actor Clifton Powell, who played Dr. King in Selma, Lord Selma, and he shared something with me that I want to ask you about. He told me that he thinks Dr. King would be disappointed at the rate of change in this country. And I wonder how much closer you think we are to Dr. King's conception of the beloved community.
I know he would be pleased to see those young people. But in reality, the March for Change had some results, but he would be disappointed if he were here today. He would be reminded of the actor who rehearses his lines, trying to get his part perfected and get it right so he can go to the stage and do his delivery. The musician will concertize and rehearse and practice and practice until she got it right and then go to perform. And he would say, you all been practicing on this 50 years after I left and you still don't have it right yet? I think that's what he would ask. You don't have it yet? Because you see, when we think about all the wonderful progress we made, and we did, through Dr. King's efforts and others, we got the Fair Housing Bill. We got the right to vote. And people stayed home, by the way. So he made and was responsible for a lot of the progress we made. But we still haven't gotten there yet. We have not gotten what he called the beloved community. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we love everybody. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we'll treat everybody right. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we'll feed the hungry and clothe the naked. Every time the issues come up, we got some opposition. So his work has not been finished. And when I got the information that this last national election, where we had the lowest minority turnout in what they said 18 years or so, I was just sick, because I'm seeing every day men walk around today who shed blood. Dr. C.T. Vivian was down at the courthouse in Alabama trying to get us registered to vote. Didn't get the vote, trying to just get registered to vote, not to burn the building down, trying to register to vote. Finally got a Voting Rights Act where we can vote now. How could people stay in bed? Because I see the blood still running down his face where he was beaten by officers of the police force when they were just trying to get us registered. We have the right, we're not exercising it. Dr. King were here today, he would just ask the questions, why not?
Do people today have a full enough understanding of who Dr. King was and what the struggle was at root level?
No. No. I saw an article where a mother was trying to figure out how she could get the message over to her 9-year-old daughter when she asked her daughter, do you know what happened to Dr. King? She said, yeah, he did wrong and they killed him. And she was just really devastated because she didn't think they were that far behind in getting the message across in her own house. And so she said she had to do something fast. But I think some people, you know, considered that the fact he must have done something wrong and they killed him. But you see, we had the FBI, you know, a high-level official in our country, just staying on Dr. King and making him a bad guy because that's what he wanted. So when you put enough information out there and circulate it well as J. Edgar Hoover did, there are people who believe he must have done something wrong to stay on him so closely and then make him such a guy that you kill him. So not enough people know what he was going through.
We talk about the assassination, but let me ask you, why was he assassinated?
There was, you know, a strong feeling that he was disturbing the country. And of course he was, I guess, when you think about it. He was an annoyance to a lot of people. You know, what's he doing now, they would ask, what now? And the thought of, you know, all Dr. King would do is put out there a thought like we're planning for the March on Washington. I even said, oh, listen, they're not going to want you in Washington tearing up that pretty green grass, you know. We think of Dr. King's presence as being destructive. And then there were those in the South where he started with the movement who said he would come to our town, tear it up, and then leave. That wasn't the case. And I was just reading an article, I didn't know this until just recently, that the mayor of Memphis said to him after the first phase of the sanitation workers' strike, they said, Dr. King, you know, we know more about our city than you do. We didn't need you coming out here destroying the tranquility of the town or something to that effect. And I want to ask you, why did you come to Memphis? And I had never known this, but Dr. King said, you know, to be honest, I was misled. But I'm here now. And I've seen some of the inequities that they're restless about. And he raised his voice, I'm here to stay until we get all of that change, until you get equity, treat people right, work them and pay them. I'm staying until we get those things corrected. Now, that was kind of a prevailing mood in a lot of cities, that he's coming to our town, tear it up, and then he's going back home. And so there were a lot of people who felt that his presence was a destructive presence.
How would you describe his bearing, his presence for young people now who don't have that, who don't know that, who don't have a sense of it, really?
The man was committed. I always tell people the one thing when I'm asked, what do you remember most and best about him? I said, I remember and admired most about him is that he practiced what he preached. He preached nonviolence and practiced it. He preached loving everybody, and he did.
That's from an earlier conversation with civil rights leader, author, and broadcasting executive Sir Nona Clayton and GPB's Tony Harris. You can honor Dr. King today with celebrations, services, and, of course, parades. Parades kick off at noon in Dublin and in Forsyth. Macon's Memorial March starts at 11. The Children's Museum of Atlanta has events for kids today, beginning at 11. The annual memorial celebration at the Good Shepherd Baptist Church in Augusta also begins at 11. There's free admission today at the Atlanta History Center and a day of service for volunteers to clean up Panola State Park in Stockbridge. That's just a partial list. You can find a full list of events at our website, gpbnews.org. We asked listeners for their personal take of Dr. King's legacy to commemorate the 50th anniversary of his death last year. Here's just one memorable voicemail.
The good morning. My name is Steve. I'm calling from Jonesboro, Georgia. I just want to let you know that my thoughts about Martin Luther King, he leave a legacy behind that will leave to the sands of time. As Christ was on earth, he fought for the rights for all, peace and love and unity for all, and so was Martin Luther King. He did not fear death, because what he was fighting for, it was for justice, peace and love and equality for all. That's my thought about Martin Luther King, a hero, and his spirit live on to the sands of time.
Thank you so much for that message, Steve. And we would love to hear from you. How do you remember Dr. King? What do his words and his example have to tell us today? You can give us a call at 404-500-9457, or you can post on our Facebook page or on Twitter. And we may just feature your comments on the show. Former President Jimmy Carter posthumously awarded Dr. King with the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1977. GPB's Sean Powers takes us back to that day at the White House with this audio postcard.
When I was a child in Georgia, there was another threat which afflicted us, and that was racial discrimination, a deprivation of human freedom, and a prohibition against the realization of the American dream for black people.
Selma sprang overnight from an obscure southern town to the front pages of world newspapers. This church was headquarters in the Negro drive for the right to vote, and it was here that Martin Luther King came to lend his support to the campaign. He pointed out,
as you may know, the Medal of Freedom is the highest civilian award that's given in our country. There are many Americans who do great things, who make us proud of them and their achievements, and who inspire us to do better ourselves. But there are some among those noble achievers who are exemplary in every way.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
The President of the United States of America awards this Presidential Medal of Freedom to Martin Luther King, Jr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was the conscience of his generation. He gazed upon the great wall of segregation and saw that the power of love could bring it down. I'd like to ask Coretta King and Dr. Martin Luther King, Sr. to come and stand beside me.
It is highly significant that you, Mr. President, a white Southerner, would become the first American president to recognize the importance of Martin Luther King Jr.'s contributions to the human rights movement in this country and bestow upon him the highest civilian award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. For us as a family, and the millions in our nation who believed in Martin Luther King Jr.'s teaching, we are greatly encouraged and feel this action is indicative of the new spirit of reconciliation which you and your administration are causing in this nation. Thank you, Mr. President, for renewing our hopes that our nation can rise to true greatness and give due honor to one of its greatest national heroes.
I was born by the river in a little
since. It's been a long, long time.
And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
And our thanks to Sean Powers, GPB's Director of Podcasting, for that audio postcard. Just ahead, learn how a bookstore on Atlanta's Sweet Auburn Avenue keeps King's dream alive. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Rosa Duffy is owner of For Keeps. That's a bookstore in Atlanta that sells rare and classic books. It's a fairly new business, and a new business owner who opened the shop on Auburn Avenue for people to explore the history of Black literature and publishing, a kind of bookish embodiment of the beloved community. I spoke with Rosa and asked her about the aesthetics of the store. It looks to me like there's a lot of 60s and 70s era books. Is that what was the draw for you there?
Yeah, so we definitely have a lot of older books, stuff that's harder to get your hands on than maybe stuff that's been published recently. So yeah, our focus is in 60s, 70s, but we still have stuff that range from then to now. So it's not only that, but it definitely, we cover that as a niche for sure.
So I guess your parents were huge influences on your love of literature.
They definitely were. So my family has very strong roots in the civil rights movement in general. So my grandma on my mom's side was involved very much in the fair housing projects in Minnesota. That's where she lives. She's also very involved in voter representation. My dad helped to build what kind of Black Atlanta is today back when he went to Morehouse. My mom went to Spelman, and she was one of the first Black women to get a dual degree at Spelman and Georgia Tech in STEM. So my family has always been very involved in Black representation and the Black message. And for that reason, you know, Black books are a part of that. So
yeah, so what was the message about the importance of books, especially by Black authors?
Well, I don't know if I was I don't know that I'm acutely aware of how they involved Black books and their importance in society in general, but Black representation and the Black message was something that was very instilled in me at a young age, and that obviously includes Black books. So my family had a big library. My grandma has still, to this day, has a huge library that I'm still trying to duplicate for the store. So it was everything, not just books, not just imagery, but everything. My dad was also a speechwriter for local Black politicians like Andy and like Maynard Jackson. So, you know, speaking the Black message was also something that was very, very instilled in me at a young age. So books help to represent that.
I like that you call him Andy.
Yeah. Oh, I call him Uncle Andy, actually. But Andrew Young, yes.
So you're deeply steeped in this this part of Atlanta culture, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And which was, of course, all of Atlanta, which is not a sort of niche.
Right.
But how about pivotal books in your life? One that I saw a photograph of was Angela Davis's Women, Race, and Class. What about
them?
Why did that stick with you?
So Women, Race, and Class was really important to me because I read it at a time that I really needed it. So I lived in New York for 8 years, and around 18 or 19, I read that book when I was starting a project, because I'm an artist as well. I was starting a project called Defend Black Womanhood, and Defend Black Womanhood was where I would weep paste around the city passages from books and photos of young Black men and women killed by the police. So it was to represent and commemorate Black folks that I feel like hadn't been seen at the time because it was so early. Doing that, I felt a lot of things that I didn't necessarily know how to express, and I didn't know that other people had felt these things. So when I read Women, Race, and Class, it helped to reassure me that what I was doing was necessary and that folks had already done it before me. And that's really why I love reading, is because I feel reassured. Really, that's what I tell people, is that I feel like, okay, I'm not alone in this fight. This fight has been done for many, many years, and many people before us have worked very hard to get where we are today. And in order to fulfill what what we really want in society. We need to be reading what folks have done before us, the steps they've taken, and kind of take it from there, not just think, you know, I'm the first person to run this rodeo and I know what I'm doing. And I kind of felt reassured and humbled when I read that book. Like, this has already been done. And in order to, you know, fulfill it, you gotta make sure you're paying homage to the folks that have done it before you.
I want to go back to, you said your work as an artist. A lot of your work had been using found paper materials and old newspapers. So not entirely surprising that you found your way here. But how did you go from there to deciding to open a bookshop in Atlanta? What was that decision-making process?
So, right. I lived in New York for a long time, like I said, 8 years, and I was sourcing materials from everywhere. So, like you said, a lot of periodicals, a lot of old newspapers, from a lot of Atlanta Daily Worlds, everything. I would use everything as a resource for my artwork. And when I would find something new, I would get really, really excited about it, and I would feel like, wow, like I said, I'm represented in a way that I've never seen before. And it ranged from, like I said, periodicals to zines, from, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. When I would find something new, I thought, wow, this is such a great feeling. And I knew that other folks would feel the same way. And so I knew that I wanted these things to be shared and not just hoarded and kept to myself. I knew that it could bring a light to other people. If it made me feel this way, it could definitely make other folks feel this way. And that's kind of what led me to opening the store / reading room, is the feeling I felt when I would get my hands on something.
You've also said that you don't really think people have to purchase anything.
Right.
But I'm guessing that was not like the number one point on your business plan.
Right. My number one point wasn't make a profit. Absolutely. But that's obviously important. I want to keep the space open. I want people to be able to come back and over the years. So it's important to make money. But I really want the interaction to happen that has been happening in the store. I've witnessed it over the past month, is that people will come in, they'll read something on those. So we have a table with the materials that aren't for sale, and we have a few benches with materials that aren't for sale. And people have looked in it and either found a connection to their hometown. You know, there are a lot of folks that aren't from Atlanta, Black folks that are here to, you know, help build a community, and they feel seen here. So they come into the store, they see something, you know, from Kentucky or from Ohio or from, you know, so they make a connection with these rare materials, and then somebody will come in the next day and use the same rare material to make a connection. So I didn't want to sell these things so that there could be multiple connections made and that people could get their hands on stuff that they might not necessarily even realize they want their hands on.
So it's a little bit like a library.
It's a little bit like a library,
But you can't take the books away.
But you can't take the books home.
You have to stay and hang out.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that is the point. But some of the books that you have acquired were rare, right? And priced as such. Others buried at the bottom of a bargain bin. So what has that been like to uncover some of these famous authors and put them on display?
I get very excited when I find something that I've been wanting for a while. I just recently found, I already have a copy, but it's my copy at home, Love Poems by Sonia Sanchez, and I wanted another for the store because it made me feel some type of way when I was upset and I read Love Poems. Even seeing the cover, and because I'm an artist, the cover is very important to me. So I see them all as little pieces of artwork. And when I found Sonia Sanchez and then realized it was signed inside, I felt like everybody could have a personal moment with the book. That's been really exciting. Even finding classics that different. I have a bunch of the Souls of Black Folks. I have a bunch of different copies with different covers. I just think the whole experience is really exciting and fun.
What's the response from people who come in? I mean, do people walk in off the street?
So my sister actually tweeted it after I only announced that I was opening the store a day before it opened. So I didn't do a great job marketing, but my sister tweeted it out. So we got a lot of response from my sister and her Twitter audience. A lot of folks have come in. Her name's Josie Duffy. I just want to give her a plug. Josie Duffy Rice. But she put it out there. And then a lot of folks have been coming from the street. We did a great sign artist painted our window, and it attracts a lot of people. His name is Lonnie. He did a great job. So a lot of folks have been coming off the street, but Atlanta has been treating me so well. Atlanta already has a sense of appreciation for their Blackness. We already have a huge community here. You know, folks call it the Black Mecca. So I feel very humbled and honored to be on Auburn Ave, which has such a history behind it, and have people come in and be so helpful and loving and encouraging, and also you know, tell me about their story and their book collections. And their, it's been very much a give and take. It's not just me putting something in the community that everybody can use. People have given me a whole bunch since I've been there. So it's been great.
That is Atlanta native Rosa Duffy. She's the owner of For Keeps. It's a bookstore of rare and vintage books on Auburn Avenue by African-American artists primarily. But not exclusively,
right?
Certainly,
it's just about the Black experience.
Exactly. Right. So let's talk about creating that space. However, when you were dreaming of it, what did you want it to feel like?
You said your grandma's library.
Right. So my grandma's library had a lot to do with it. But even I spoke to her about what I wanted the space to be like. And when I was a little bit nervous opening, I asked her, you know, some of her advice, and she was telling me, treat it as your home. So a lot of this stuff you already have at home, you're very familiar with. Just treat it as an extension of your home and you trying to share. And when she said that, it was very, very helpful for me. You know, it helped me grow the store into what I really wanted it to be before I opened. So it's just a relaxed setting. I don't want people to feel intimidated by the materials, because I feel like in a lot of spaces, they're behind glass, or they're $800, or they're this, or they're that, and they feel really untouchable. And I wanted it to be a space where there were comfy chairs, a relaxed atmosphere. You know, I play a lot of Charles Mingus in the store because it's relaxing, and, you know, it encourages you to kind of breathe and read and take in the material. So I just wanted it to be comfy. You know, I wanted it to be inviting.
So what are some of the books that have, you know, people have picked up? You said that there are some that you don't sell, but
right,
that people have really responded to.
So I have an old Black Scholar edition, or Black Scholar issue of the Black Scholar magazine. And it has a Shirley Chisholm interview in there about, I can't exactly remember, but the response from that article alone has been really big. People have been really, really interested in that. I just put out a small zine called Mainstream, and I think the edition is from the 60s. See, I get new stuff every day, so I get really, every day I'm excited about something new. So I'm talking about my most recent discoveries. And that Mainstream zine has a poem by Patrice Lumumba. So we have a range of everything, and people will sit at the table for, you know, going on. I've had people there until I close. It's just very, you get lost in all the stuff that's provided. And I have a bunch of old Jets too, which
Jet
I didn't
magazine.
Really, a Jet magazine. Uh-huh. I didn't really think that would be something that people responded to like they do, only because it's such a staple in Black homes that I didn't feel like this would be such a surprise to see. But people, I mean, I think it's a bit of nostalgia too. People just really are excited when they see the Jet magazines.
So the Lumumba is one that I saw.
Right.
It was on the Instagram feed.
Yes.
And if you can just remind listeners, he was a assassinated leader, elected leader of
right.
Congo at
right.
the time.
Of
it was
course.
Congo.
Yeah.
So not a figure that a lot of people know. So in a way, you are providing a community space, but is there a teaching sort of angle here? Are you sneakily teaching people?
Well, I definitely want people to expand their idea of Blackness and their idea of Black leaders, because I think, you know, the general population is taught about, you know, two or three very important people. It's not that they're not important, but we've gotten that message over and over, and we understand that message. And in the story, you can learn more about that message. But there's also other people that we need to know about. We need that, you know, the imagery to be broadened and understand that you can be this, you can be that. There's not two people. It's not a binary thing, and you get to choose from these two people, and that those are the people that represent you as a Black person. There's other people to learn from. So yes, absolutely. I do think, I just want people to feel seen. That's
so
my whole thing.
It's funny, Rosa, when we were mic checking you, my producer asked, you know, what are you doing afterwards? And you're like, I'm going to open up books and, you know,
yeah.
Put the price tags on books. Your life is
yeah.
very different.
Oh, yeah. So it's definitely different. So I've just been ordering I order every day. It's become an issue. And so, yeah, I'm trying to just get all my inventory out. I like people to see all of it.
You're a retailer now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for speaking
thank
with us.
Thank you
and
so much.
Best of luck with the shop.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Atlanta native artist and now book owner of For Keeps, Rosa Duffy. It's a shop for rare and classic Black books, and it's on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. As we honor Dr. King today, we invite your thoughts on his life and legacy. What did he mean to you, to your family? Where are we as a country on the long march to the promised land? You can let us know. Call 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk or post your thoughts on our Facebook group. GPB's On Second Thought. Our show is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Don Smith is our Dean of Grammar. Amy Kiley is Senior Producer. Special thanks today to our engineer, Tyler Morris.
I am tired
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would have been 90 years old this January 15th. After his assassination at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis in April of 1968, gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, a friend of King's, was asked to sing Precious Lord, Take My Hand at his funeral. We'll leave you with that song today as we close our celebration of his life and legacy. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. Me.